Blog Talk Radio.
You may not be paid for the job.
And some of you will
Good evening and good morning to everybody and anybody wherever you are. And welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your humble hosts, Kel Fritzy and Tim Burton. Hi, Tim.
Hi there, Kel, and how the devil are you this evening?
I am infidelly fine.
And I'm unbelievably well as well.
Unbelievably well. I love that. Oh, boy.
Oh,
ladies and gentlemen, we have a guest joining us on the program today, and that would be Mr. Paul Weston of the Liberty GB Party. I put a brief description of who this gentleman is in the show highlights. For those in archive listen, I will reiterate. Paul joined the British Freedom Party in late 2011, but he became disillusioned with the direction it was taking, over which he felt he had little control. So in 2013, he established the Liberty GP with a small group of ex-British freedom activists who shared his political ideology. Now, the mission statement of the Liberty GB Party is as follows. Liberty GB will address all the political issues Great Britain currently faces, something the three main parties, along with the UKIP, so conspicuously fail to do. My apologies. The Liberal Democrats, Labour...
Thanks, just helping.
The Liberal Democrats, Labour, and Conservatives manifestly refuse to discuss the most important issues of our time, namely mass immigration from third world, the steady rise of fundamentalists, Islam, and the hijacking of traditional British culture and institutions by well-organized left-wing progressives. There is no guarantee at such a late stage that Britain can be saved, but Liberty GB will endeavor to put a stop to our rapidly accelerating descent into economic, educational, moral, cultural, and social ruin. Britain could be a wonderful country again, but it will take politics bordering on the revolutionary to achieve this vision. And with that, we are more than pleased to welcome Paul Weston. And Paul, hello and welcome to the program. How are you today?
Hi, Kel. I'm very well. Thanks for having me on. And hello to Tim as well. I haven't spoken to you for a while. I can't compete, by the way, with your little humorous intros there with infidelity. Well, I'm afraid as soon as I heard it, I thought I've got to think of something, and I've been sitting here thinking, nope, there's nothing there at all.
Oh boy, I'm creating my own dictionary, I think, and let me see. Tim likes to throw me off by giving me neologisms, and I frantically Google looking up, what's that word Tim used? What's that word? Tim is terrible.
Yes, I do find that Kel gets thoroughly discombobulated on occasion, so I like to step in and help her out now and again.
There you go. But, Paul, it is a real pleasure to have you on our program today. There's a lot of people quite excited that you are here. And one thing, of course, I did the preamble there. You did join the British Freedom Party. What happened there that made you feel that things just were not going the way you felt they should be going?
Well, it was really the influence of two people, but one person particularly that was ex-BNP, ex-British National Party. And they came across 99% of the time as being quite reasonable. But then at certain points, something would happen. And the actual main reason why it all fell apart was they wanted to resurrect old battles with people they had fallen out with in the past in the British National Party, and then splits from there. And we were just saying, look, nobody cares about that. Nobody cares about the old battles between these people. Just forget about it. It's not important. And they were absolutely determined not to forget about it. So it led to all sorts of little rows and bickerings. And I just thought, no, sod it. I think it's much better just starting afresh without these people. So that's when we, George Whale and I, set up. George was somebody incredibly important to British freedom. And he was not treated well at all by these ex-BNP people. George and I said, no, sod it, we'll push off and start our own thing. So that's what we did in March last year with Liberty GB.
How hard was that to do? Establishing a new party must be very difficult. Did you run into a lot of walls in doing that? Because that the Liberty GB, it's a very well-known, it's a very young party, but it's very well-known, and it's garnering a lot of respect, and you are running for the Euro elections. How well do you think the Liberty GB is actually being received overall, though?
I honestly don't know. You know, we get when we get positive feedback on it, you know, people are saying that this is just the sort of party we want. You're talking about all the real issues that affect us, that you don't go down that whole route of talking about some Zionist conspiracy theory and mud people and all the other stuff that some of these sort of further to the right nationalists talk about. So I think that we have exactly the right sort of mix of policies. You know, we will talk about these things, but we are talking about it in a civilized way. And we're not talking about it in an aggressive way either. You know, we are not saying we don't like black people or brown people or Muslim people. We are saying, look, we feel threatened by what's going on. We love our country and we love our culture. We don't hate anybody, and we simply want to preserve our country and our culture and our way of life that so many people have died for. And this is being very well received because this hasn't really been tried before. So, you know, from the far right side of it, it hasn't really been tried before. And on the other spectrum of politics, with the conservatives and Labour and liberals, then they're never going to talk about these things at all. You know, they're all very civilized people, but they're not going to talk about these sort of things because they're too frightened.
Paul, is it just, do you think, that they're too frightened, or do you think they're influenced by other interests, like, for example, economic interests with the Saudi petrodollar? That's something that's mentioned a great deal when I talk to people. To what extent do you think that influences the policies that the mainstream parties have made over the past 20 years or so?
Well, I can't say anything for sure on that, but you know, one thing we do know is that Saudi Arabia has put 90,000 million petrodollars into the West over the last 30 or 40 years, and that has obviously brought a great deal of influence. I don't know if it's brought a great deal of influence with politicians, but I know that it's bought and paid for most of the mass media, it would seem, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that the top people at the BBC, for example, have been paid off by Saudi Arabia, because nothing else would explain why they're on their knees before them, groveling before Islam and attacking people like us who, you know, bear in mind the BBC's pet loves in life are feminism, progressive policies, homosexuality, all these sort of things, and they know for a fact that Islam hates all of those, yet they still will side with Islam above anything else. So the problem then comes when we get to the politicians, is that they rely on people like the BBC to make sure their careers run smoothly. If the BBC decide to do a hatchet job on a politician who has said Islam presents a great threat to this country, the BBC would jump on them. They would be out of a job within a week. So, yes, the petrodollars have worked, not aimed particularly at politicians, but aimed at the media that control the politicians, and the politicians run scared of the media who are in the pay of Saudi Arabia. So that's my take on it anyway.
How do you think this is best addressed? I mean, if we were to look at the ideal scenario, which is to say a Liberty GB landslide at the next election, they say a week is a long time in politics and you never know what can happen in 4 or 5 months. But seriously, where would you start when it comes to trying to rein in the media that present this biased view that everybody seems to swallow?
Well, that's really put me on the spot, Tim. What do you do with them? I mean, you know, I look at Liberty GB. You know, we have the great advantage over, you know, we're tiny, we're small, we're new, but we have a great advantage over proper established political parties in that we can say exactly what we think because we've got nothing to lose, whereas they have a great deal to lose. So we are basically saying at the moment that we are quite literally a revolutionary political movement, and we will do whatever it takes to make sure that this country retains its majority British people as a race and its majority British culture as a culture, and we will do anything to make sure that we keep those things. I'm not suggesting that we start taking the Director General of the BBC out and shooting him, but I am suggesting that we put these people on trial for subverting the culture and people of this country. And I mean that quite literally. You know, they need to be aware that what they're doing is evil and wicked and subversive and treacherous. And they need, if Liberty GB was in power today, I would have a full-scale investigation into the background and political ideology of the top 10% of the BBC, and I would hold them to account, and I would, if the courts found them guilty of these things, bang them up for treason, quite literally.
Yeah, sorry, Kel, go ahead.
Oh, no, Tim, I was just looking at the Liberty GB website, and one thing I noticed is that you have a wall of shame here, and you have people such as, and oh, I just lost my entire page here. My apologies. I'll get it back. There we are. You have a wall of shame here, Britain's enemies within, and, of course, Feyyaz Maguire, rather, is prominently featured in there, as well as George Galloway and others. Are these formidable foes? George Galloway in particular, I want to get to Feyyaz in a moment, but George Galloway in particular, what is wrong with him? Because he is, he's infamous. As a matter of fact, I'm in Canada, and we've prevented him from coming to Canada to speak here because of his affiliation with Islam.
Mm-hmm. Galloway is very keen on money, very keen on money indeed. And he was involved in some, I can't remember which country it was in. It was one of the Middle Eastern countries, and he was raising money to save some girl who had been injured or some such thing. And it was basically a front for raising lots of money. And I think that someone somewhere is lining George Galloway's pockets. I believe he has 5 houses now, which seems an awful lot for a chap from his background. So I think he's in the pay of someone, and he's a left winger, so he has quite happily allied himself with Islam because he thinks that what he'd like to see in this country is social chaos and anarchy, and out of anarchy will rise communism. And as Marx said, he'll stand astride the wreckage of Colossus. So the left ally themselves with Islam, particularly so if they can get some money out of it. And I reckon that is probably a fairly good summation of George Galloway.
And now I want to talk about this other gentleman, Feyyaz Maguire, who freed Tell Mama, rather. And Feyyaz Maguire is a real thorn in the side of me, and especially with my co-host, Tim. Tim has been my co-host for a very long time, well, half a year, I would wager we've been going on. And when this came about, I was rather distressed. I have been doing everything I can to get the word out that this mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist is not going to get away with taking our Tim to task. And I am so eternally grateful to Liberty GB. When we come across cases like this, Paul, how does that make you feel? What do we do about people like this?
Well, I think that Tim has a fantastic opportunity. Now, I don't know if Feyyaz Mughal was quite aware of who he was dealing with when he so flippantly decided to take Tim to task. But
I'm sure
Tim has
this.
I'm sure he wasn't either. But now Tim has got people like Raymond Ibrahim and Robert Spencer interested in his case, and I think even now some Professor Hans Jansen in Denmark is volunteering to pay out of his own pocket to come over and act as an expert witness, and he's another Islamic scholar. So Mughal is going to have his hands full with this, and I don't know how much you've discussed this and how much I should say on it here, but I think that Tim's idea of turning it into a thing about Takiya You know, and the moment that Mughal swears his oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth on the Quran, which is what he's going to do, you have to say, you know, case over. You simply cannot swear to tell the truth on a book that mandates the lie, that mandates lying in order to further the cause of Islam. So Tim is going to have a great time. I think he's up for a scrap anyway, and he's
yes.
got right he's got right and moral values on his side here, and I think he's going.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. And Tim, take it away.
Yes, well, you're quite right, Paul. When Fiaz Mughal laid these complaints against me, which was going back into June, I'm sure he had no idea that I was anything other than a nobody who, with a Twitter account, who was being slightly rude about him personally, and I'm sure he was offended by it. I mean, the fact that it actually took 6 months for the police to take his complaint and interview me and charge me, I suppose he's neither here nor there. It doesn't say a great deal about the efficiency of West Midlands finest, but I'll let that pass. But yes, I'm quite sure that he had no idea that there would be this level of support that has been generated as a result of the case. And I have to say right at this stage that I'm eternally grateful to you, Paul, and to Liberty GB for supporting me in this, because I'm sure a lot of people faced with a criminal charge hanging over them, and not a minor criminal charge either. We're talking about something that could, in theory, carry substantial prison time if it all goes pear-shaped on the day. There is the possibility of, well, it could be up to 6 months in imprisonment. So it's not an insignificant thing, and I'm sure a lot of people might well be devastated by it. But I really am, as you say, I'm certainly up for a scrap, and I have got a lot of people who've expressed interest in what is happening with the case. And as you say, Professor Janssen very kindly volunteered, without any real prompting from me, to come over and to talk about Taqiya as an expert witness in my defence on the day, which is just astoundingly, that's just an astoundingly wonderful thing, I think, for somebody with such an established reputation like that who would come over and volunteer to do that. I'm just so grateful that there are people like that in the world that understand the significance of what people like Fiaz Mughal are trying to do and are willing to stand up and be counted and to help to stop it.
Well, no, exactly. I think everyone is aware now that there is a concerted effort for these, you know, to sort of implement Sharia blasphemy laws across everybody in the West. And people are not going to stand for it. Everyone will get very upset. Tell me, Tim, if you lose in the magistrates' court, you will appeal to the Crown Court for this.
Yes, indeed. This was one of the things that I discussed with my solicitor right at the start, because he said, you're going to be asked if you want to have your case heard in the Crown Court or in the magistrates' court. And I naturally said, not knowing too much about legal procedures, I said, what's the significance? And he said, well, in the first instance, with a case like this, you may as well have it heard in the magistrates' court. But if it goes against you, you can appeal to Crown Court, and that is certainly what I would do. As far as I'm concerned, I'm prepared to take it all the way as far as I can, because I think the issues involved are so important. I mean, it's quite beyond just a simple harassment case, and goes to the heart of what it means to have an opinion and free speech in a civilized democracy in the West today. So I think I have no alternative. There are plenty of people who I'm sure feel quite strongly about it, but if they were attacked in the same way, they'd have all sorts of things to be concerned about, like whether they would keep their job. There are certain sectors of employment in the UK, as I'm sure you're aware, that if you have any kind of suspicion hanging over you that you're a racist, bigoted, fascist, hateful, intolerant Islamophobe, then you can be out of a job very, very quickly. It can be a career killer, especially in education, local government and other public sector jobs. I'm in a fortunate position in that I can stand up without these worries hanging over me, because that's just the stage of life and the position that I'm in. And I think that I owe it to everybody who's supported me and everybody who is a supporter of free speech and democracy in this country, and indeed everyone who's a supporter of free speech and democracy around the world. I owe it to them, if they can't stand up, somebody like me or somebody like us have to stand up and make that case clear that we're not just going to let them get away with it.
No, absolutely right. Well done. And I don't know, you know, I would love to see you lose in the magistrates' court, to be quite honest. I would love to see this go all the way up to the European Court of Human Rights, because you can be ignored in a magistrates' court. If this went up to the European Court of Human Rights and they were forced very much against their will to come down on your side, it would be fantastic. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the moment you walk in there and your solicitor makes the case that that this guy is trying to do you for racial harassment when all you did is talk about a religion, I think they're going to throw it out. So, you know, he's just gone for you initially, thinking that, oh, you know, he'll just back down and he'll crumble. But no, he doesn't know quite what he's bitten off yet, and I'm looking forward to what goes on.
Oh yeah, I've been saying to people that if anybody happens to be in Birmingham on the day, please bring some popcorn, because it's definitely going to be entertaining. Sit at the back of the court and have a nice afternoon out. The fact is that I am quite sure that he doesn't know. He's got form for this sort of thing. That's what I was going to say. He's got, before he decided he was going to try and make a case against me, he had form for using litigation in order to attack people who had been critical either of Islam, the Quran, the Prophet Muhammad, on social media. I've talked to one or two of these people who've been on the sharp end of Fiaz Magal's bully boy tactics, and you know they've told me it's quite an unpleasant experience. But as you say, I'm up for a scrap, and I'm ready to take it all the way.
Good stuff, eh? What do you think of that, Kel?
I am absolutely amazed by the attention that this case is drawing. It is drawing international attention. As a matter of fact, Tim and myself, we host another program called The Freedom Loving Infidels on the Radio Jihad Network. And last week we had Pamela Geller on, and she was rather keen on being able to testify on Tim's behalf as well. Unfortunately, she is banned from England, so she might have to do something via satellite. But one thing that I do appreciate is that I am very, very pleased with Liberty GB, and I'll reiterate this, in that you are showing him 110% support, and that you have set up a Help Defend Liberty GB's Tim Burton against hate crime charges, and you have a donate button there. And I put that in the chat room for everybody.
Oh, thank you, Bill.
And Tim is right. If you are in the Birmingham area, bring popcorn, sit in the galley. I said bring your popcorn and ping it at the back of a muggle's head, but Tim told me I should not encourage that behavior.
Yes, they do tend to frown on that in magistrates' court, so I'm just...
Oh, but I do want to ask you something else that came to my attention is the fact that you are so... well known in North America. As you know, I'm in North America, and we have a very, very, very vested interest in what is going on in Europe, in the UK in particular. And when we see things like the Islamic no-go zones and the Sharia zones and things like that, we're getting concerned. Paul, how far behind do you think we are in North America if we don't start controlling it right now? Canada seems to be doing quite well. The United States, not so much because of the current Obama administration. But what do you have any advice for us in North America, our politicians in particular, that refuse to listen to some of us?
Well, Stephen Harper is your prime minister still.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, Stephen Harper apparently has been advised by, I can't remember the guy's name, but that he's linked to the Canadian website Blazing Cat Fur. And from what I gather, Harper knows what's going on. He's very open to resisting it. I don't know what the other politicians are like and what the media is like particularly. But I would think that you're probably 20 years behind us and France particularly and Holland. And all I can really say to Canada is look closely at what is going on in Europe and look closely at Britain, France and Holland, and don't make the mistakes that we are in the middle of making. You know, you still have time not to allow that to build and develop. You know, you've got time to make sure that the people in the mosques are lectured or proselytized in English, so you know what they're saying. You can say no Saudi imams here, no foreign funding for these mosques,
mm-hmm.
no Sharia finance, all this sort of stuff. Start prosecuting imams who are talking about killing homosexuals and lashing women with a whip for the effrontery to have been raped by a Muslim guy. You know, so all of these things you can do, and you can say all the time, listen, we don't want to get into this situation that is happening in Europe.
Exactly. And Stephen Harper, he holds no love for any Islamic movement. When he went on his trip to Israel last month, he took an entourage with him, and the National Council of Canadian Muslims, formerly known as CARE Canada, they were rather upset about a certain rabbi that was going to be part of his entourage. And this rabbi, I've met this rabbi, he's a wonderful man. And the reason why they took such umbrage with this particular rabbi is because he hosted an event with Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer in Toronto in September.
Oh, is this Rabbi Shifrin? Shifrin.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so the National Council of Canadian Muslims, they changed their name because they wanted to disassociate themselves from their parent company, the Council of American Islamic Relations, and we know all about them and the Holy Land Foundation. But they took umbrage to this, and they filed a complaint. And one of the spokespersons of Stephen Harper's cabinet, his office rather, came on and said his name is... Jason McDonald, he came on, he said, we will not take seriously criticism from an organization with documented ties to terrorist organizations such as Hamas. And so, well, the CARE CON, they took offense to that, and they filed a suit in court in which they said that if the Harper administration does not apologize, they will follow through with this suit. Now, Stephen Harper, he's not going to kowtow to this group. As a matter of fact, the Canadian Air Federation called the then immigration minister, Jason Kenney, a professional whore because of our staunch support of Israel. And Jason Kenney just said, okay, fine, that's the way you want to play. He pulled their funding.
Mm-hmm.
So Canada is kind of on the ball with a few things. Unfortunately, we do have politicians, Paul, that will not pay attention to what I consider the scourge, the Islamic threat that we see in North America. So you think we're about 20 years behind then, eh?
I think so, but I'm not up to speed with Muslim demographics in Canada. How many, what's the percentage of the population there now?
Canada's population is bordering on 35 million, and we have 1 million Muslims right now.
Okay, so I imagine that is under a certain age group.
That's about. We're sitting around. I believe it's around 4%. We're sitting at right now. So my numbers might be off just a little.
but probably 15-20% aged under 10, which is what the situation is. Well, worse than that here. You know, people always get very confused. You know, lefties especially will say, "Why do you feel so threatened when they only make up 5% of the population in your country?" And you have to explain to left-wingers very patiently, as though to a small, slightly retarded child, that things aren't always as they appear. And there are 60 million people in Britain, but the majority of the English are, and the Scots and the Welsh, now the majority of us are over the age of 50. I think it might even be over the age of 60 now. And so as a whole, yes, you know, they're only 5%. But if you look at the under 15-year-olds, I think they're now up to 25%, and they're having four children each. So that 25% within one generation means that we have 50-50, us and them, Muslims, non-Muslims, within one generation. And if they want to attack us with machetes and take the country over, they probably could, but we, you know, obviously we have the army, so that probably won't happen. But what they can do is block vote a Muslim prime minister in before 2040, 2050. So that demographic threat is enormous, and I'm assuming that you're perhaps not 20 years behind us in that case, if they are already 5% of your population.
This is our concern in Canada. Those of us who are involved in the counter-jihad movement, when we see the demographics, and what we're seeing as well is that the couple, maybe they emigrate from Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, and they have their children here, but all of a sudden they are sponsoring a cousin or an aunt or a sister, and that's the second, third, or fourth wife, and they're propagating in that fashion as well. You're right about the block vote. That is our concern, because we're already seeing staunch Muslims taking positions of authority within our political system. Calgary, Alberta, voted in the first Muslim mayor, and he is very good friends with the federal leader of the Liberal Party, Justin Trudeau, who is very much an Islamic sympathizer.
Ah, the Trudeau clan. What a horrible, horrible Pierre. Was it Pierre Trudeau?
Elliott Trudeau, yeah.
What a disgusting communist. Oh, was he actually a communist or just a communist sympathizer?
We don't know. He was certainly a socialist, but he's the one who revised our Constitution and gave us the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 1982 and introduced official multiculturalism, which has always been a thorn in our sides, because official multiculturalism means that your culture is equal to mine. And, of course, we know that the culture of Islam is not compatible with the culture of the West.
Absolutely not. Mind you, I suppose you can't really blame poor old Pierre Trudeau for behaving oddly. He must be extremely upset ever since Mick Jagger shagged his wife.
Margaret. Oh, gosh, but I'm going to pass the mic back to Tim, because I think he has a question for you, Paul.
Yes. Well, I'm sure somebody with the statesman-like demeanour of Mr. Trudeau wouldn't hold that sort of thing against Mick Jagger, surely, after all this time. Anyway, on to more serious matters. One of the things I've been doing over the past few weeks is talking to representatives, one particular representative, a chap by the name of Mike Holt in Australia, who runs an organisation called Restore Australia. And one of the things he's pushing for is an amendment to the Australian Constitution, and he's been working with a group of guys who have sat down for the last 10 years or so to work out something workable that could be put in place to amend the Australian Constitution. And he was asking me about what would be the chances of us doing such a thing over here. And my opinion, as it was, because I'm not really a constitutional expert, was that we couldn't really do the same thing over here, because our Constitution has been made up really in a sort of sticking plaster fashion over time, ever since the Magna Carta of 1215 and the what is it, the Bill of Rights in 1689. Various laws have been patched on higgledy-piggledy almost in the intervening years, and if we wanted to unravel it all and make a constitution fit for the 21st century, which is what Mike Holt is planning for Australia, assuming he gets into power and has a chance to do so, what would you think about the nature of our constitution and whether it would help or hinder the kind of reforms that we would need? Again, I'm assuming that at some point in the future, Liberty GB got into power and had a free hand on making the changes that were necessary to bring our country back on track, what would you, if anything, what would you be looking to do with the constitution that we've currently got?
Oh, blimey, Tim! You know, back in the formation of America, when Jefferson and Co. got together, they must have had a hell of a long time to think about it before any bastard asked them. Surely.
I have rather thrown that at you, haven't I? I'm only asking because I have a feeling that we are really at a point that if we're going to undertake serious reform in every level, we're going to be hampered by what we already have in place. I mean, I personally think that the way in which we've run things in Great Britain over the past, 800 years, say, has actually worked, give or take the odd war with France and Spain and that sort of thing. It's worked reasonably well, but now we're faced with something that's completely different. We've never faced it before, and in order to get things happening, we're going to have to take draconian measures. And I just wondered whether you saw constitutional issues as being part of that. If you feel that it's way down the list of priorities, please say so, because I certainly don't have a strong view on the subject, and I'm just asking in case there's something you wanted to throw into the mix there.
Well, you know, all I could really say on that is that, you know, as you say, it's been this hundreds and hundreds of years of constant evolution to get us where we maybe not are today, but where we were 50, 60 years ago. And the ideology that was sort of evolved into what was our unwritten constitution was then taken to places like America and Canada and Australia, and which essentially are freer than we are today. And when you look at the 80 countries around the world that were once run by Britain, 40 of them are now democratic, peaceful democracies. The 40 that got rid of our unwritten rules and laws and common law and the unwritten constitution are places like Somalia and Sierra Leone and places that reverted back to type after we left. So, yes, I think we should have a written constitution. I think it should revolve around the primacy of British culture and should revolve around the primacy of British people. And we should certainly have something along the lines of the First Amendment to America's First Amendment to guarantee our free speech. But the trouble we have, you know, we are talking about a post-revolutionary society if we were able to do this, because I think the American Declaration of Independence, the American Constitution is 23 pages long or 18 pages long or something. The European Union Constitution is 60,000 pages long. Now, you know, it's written by lawyers and it's written in a manner that we are never able to understand it, even if we could get through one page, let alone 60,000 pages. So first of all, we have to get out of the European Union before we can have anything remotely associated with a British constitution. But I'm in full agreement with you. We should probably, as Liberty GB, we should come up with a short, sharp, concise constitution. Absolutely.
Okay. Before I go any further on that subject, and it's something which I guess we could develop perhaps at a later stage when we have another show perhaps, but we've got a caller on the line Frank is on the line. Would you like to take a call from Frank? I'll just pass it back to Kel because she's got the buttons and things to press to organise it. Over to you,
right.
Kel.
And there you go. And Frank, welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. You are speaking with Paul Weston. What's your question and what's your comment?
Well, yeah, thanks. Good evening. First off, Paul, I've followed you on YouTube and everywhere, and I really admire what you're doing, and I feel privileged to speak to you. Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you, Frank.
But to chip in with what you're saying about the Constitution, last Saturday at the EDL rally in Slough, there's a gentleman called Albert Burgess, a retired policeman, and he's published a small book. It's 28 pages, and it's The Layman's Guide to the English Constitution. £2 it was. I'm going to get some more. I'm going to send up and get some more, but I'm just going to read one line just to whet your appetite off the second page.
All right.
A constitution is the property of a nation and not those who exercise government. Thomas Paine.
Mm-hmm.
So,
absolutely.
And, well, that says it all. I mean, so I've been turning through the book, and it's easy reading. It is a layman's guide, but it will whet your appetite for more. I've got a feeling if we really look at this, we won't have to draw up a new one, because our ancestors beat themselves to a standstill to come to this conclusion, and there's no need
absolutely,
for us to do it.
Absolutely, Frank. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to let Paul address that for you right now.
Thank you.
No, I think you're spot on with that, and I've heard of this Albert Burgess guy. I've forgotten the website that he runs, but I've seen him on a few videos, and I've seen someone else who works with him, and I am going to I've got it as a link here somewhere. I'm gonna look it up again, and I will get hold of this. You say it's £2, and you can just buy it over the web. Frank,
the chat room's not working for me. So,
you still there, Frank?
Okay. Yeah, can you hear me still?
We can hear you now, Frank.
Oh, it's all gone Dalek noises.
Huh.
Yeah, well, my chat room is not loading up.
Oh, that's okay, Frank. I think Paul got the gist of your comment and your query. And if you have one final question for Paul, we appreciate that. Okay, it looks like we've lost Frank. Okay, I don't know what's going on with the switchboard, but it would appear that Frank is having issues with his audio. But
well,
Paul, would you like to expand on that?
I was just going to say that if Frank can still hear me, I know about the Burgess guy, I know his site, I am going to go on there, and I am going to order it, and I wouldn't have done so without the reminder from Frank. So that is, I'm extremely grateful to you, Frank, for that, and I hope that you can hear me say that.
Yeah, I still have him on the switchboard, but he couldn't hear us, it would appear, so I don't know what's going on there. So, Frank, thank you very, very much for calling in. Now, I don't know how long we can have you on with us, Paul, but I wanted to switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about something about maybe there are those that are not so keen on the Liberty GB Party, and I was reading an article out of the British Resistance, and they were less than laudatory of the Liberty GB movement, and they seem to think that you're some sort of Zionist party.
Yes, I'm a Zionist lickspittle traitor and a sellout to his country.
Lovely.
I thought sort of language had gone out with the Communist Party about 40 years ago, but apparently somebody's still using it.
Well, it's all part of that lovely broad family of socialism, whether it's Hitler's National Socialism or Stalin's International Socialism. But the British Resistance fight, they describe themselves as National Socialists. You know, they are Nazis, and they were initially very upset with the split from people from the BNP to British Freedom, because the reason that they left, this was before I joined, but the reason that people left the BNP was they were saying, listen, we're not going to win if we promote ethno-nationalism. We've got to talk about cultural nationalism. And at the time, I thought that is probably I didn't really agree with that. I think that ethno-nationalism today is extremely important, just because of the weight of numbers. But at the time, I was thinking that if we adopt a cultural nationalism and we say, listen, we don't mind what color you are, what race you are, what religion you are, as long as you adhere to British norms, then you're acceptable here. But the weight of numbers is far too big, really, for that. So initially, the British Resistance side absolutely hated us for the cultural nationalist angle and for splitting the BNP as a result of it. And then after we became, this was literally only a couple of months ago, we decided that we are not becoming a massively popular party based on cultural nationalism. Let's just be 100% honest and say we are not white supremacists, but we are promoting an ideology that retains the British native people as a majority and their culture as a cultural majority. So that should really have appeased the British Resistance site boys. But unfortunately, I went to Israel a couple of years ago, and I went into the Holocaust Museum, and there is a little sign there saying that out of politeness you should wear a skull cap. So I thought, I'm in a Holocaust Museum, I will, out of respect and politeness, wear a skull cap. And there was a picture taken, and the British Resistance site got hold of the picture. And so now, of course, I'm a fervent, rabid Zionist that wants to take over the world with my Jewish co-conspirators. It's all, you know, I mean, they're insane. They are literally little clones of the Nazi Party. And even the merest hint of not wanting to kill Jews and destroy Israel makes you a Zionist in their eyes. And that, sadly, is the position I'm in as far as they're concerned. But I think it's fairly irrelevant because they're quite disgusting people.
Yeah, I actually had a quick look at the link to British Resistance. It was pointed out to me just before I came on the show. And I agree with you, I find it very sad that people feel that they have to attack Israel, because at the end of the day, Israel is on the front line against the global jihad, and all those people who think there's going to be peace in the Middle East once Israel is no longer on the scene are going to be sadly mistaken, because the global jihad will then advance to its next goal and onward until there is only really going to be people like us who will staunchly stand up and fight to keep what we have. We'll be the only people left. But I'm just saddened that more people can't see that, and that Jew hatred seems to be so predominant amongst some of these groups.
It is, and it's a. Now, I've been talking to people who, about the Second World War and Hitler and England and Britain. And so many of them say, we would never have, Britain could never have allowed a man like Hitler to rise to the top, because it simply isn't British. But out of all of the European countries, we see a lot of anti-Semitism in France, but that comes principally from the Muslim community. But you see very little of this when you see it in some of the East European countries. Romania and places like that are very anti-Semitic. But in Western European countries, it's very rare to see it, except really for England and Britain. We have a massive far right wing anti-Semitic following in this country, and they are paranoid about it. Everything is the fault of the Jews. The Jews control the media. The Jews control the banks. The Jews control the educational things. Everything is geared around towards this crazy Zionist conspiracy. And I would, No, I'm a really open-minded man. I would, if it was true. Now, I know for a fact that political correctness, the Frankfurt School, the people involved in that were Jews. You know, they were German Jews that got out of Germany whilst Hitler was coming to power, and they have done a great deal of damage. But as far as I'm concerned, they are communists before they're Jews. And this is something that the far right don't seem to be able to forget about. They just label all subversive types in this country now as sort of potential Zionists. And I don't understand it. It is unusual for a European, Western European country to do it. I'm as baffled as the next person. But as I say, I'm open-minded, and I say to these people, look, perhaps what you're saying is right. Direct me to some information, to some credible articles or books that actually back up what you're saying, that Rothschilds are behind this worldwide Zionist conspiracy. If I can read proper facts on this and find out that it actually is true, then I will become a person such as yourself. Until you prove this to me, then I am going to defend Israel and defend Jews and defend democracy rather than bringing in National Socialism, a.k.a. Nazism. So until you can do that, naff off. And they haven't as yet been able to direct me to anything except for David Duke.
So they haven't inundated you with the literature that you requested. Your front room isn't full of books detailing exactly how the evil Jews have got these nefarious plans for the world all organised. Well, I'm sorry. You have to excuse me if I chuckle. It's not really a laughing matter, because at the end of the day, all this really does is to distract people's attention from what, in my view, and I'm sure it's your view too as well, Paul, the most important issue that's facing us. Because if we can't resolve this particular issue with the encroachment of Islam on our society and all the factors surrounding it, in particularly including demographics, if we don't solve that problem, we're not going to have that much in the way of other problems to worry about. Things like climate change, it just isn't going to be an issue at all when you set it against the consequences that unrestrained and unchecked Islamic encroachment is going to have on our civilization. But with that, I'll pass the mic back to Kel. And Kel, I think you've got a question you want to ask Paul. Hello, Kel, you there? Hello, Kel?
We've lost her.
Ah, okay. I was wondering if it was me.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Here I am. I put myself on mute because I was in the green room fielding a call. But, yes, when we chuckle, it's more like sardonic, because we just have to shake our heads in wonderment in what goes through these people's minds. And in particular, I understand there's a lot of ignorance when it comes to Islam out there, but there's also a lot of dimitude, and that the politicians are afraid to deal with the elephant in the room. But you made a video a while back, and it was titled, "My Name is Paul Weston, and I Am a Racist. If it's racist to defend your country, then that's what I am." And I placed that on Red Fox Blogger about a year ago, I think. And whenever we have discussions about Islam, or whenever we, any of us, go into a chat room, for example, or a comment section on the mainstream media comment boards, when you criticize Islam, they label you as a racist, and we're getting a little sick and tired of that label. It's very much, I think that Islam has diluted it quite handily over the last few years. What do you think about that, Paul?
Well, I think Islam has certainly helped, and you know, the reason I made that video was because I was sick to death of people being browbeaten in television debates and radio debates by people accusing them of being racist. So you know, at the end of the day, they would do what everybody has been doing for ages now and say, "I'm not a racist, but." And I thought, no bollocks to that. Just come out and say, listen, according to your definition of what a racist is, I am a dreadful, awful, ghastly, terrible racist. Fine. I accept that. Now, you can't shut me down with that accusation. Now, debate with me over some facts about mass immigration, some facts about Islam, some facts about the fact that a real race of people, the English, the British, are looking at a very perilous future. And you talk to me and accuse me of being a racist when I'm trying to defend a race and a culture from foreign people coming into the country. And you, as an Englishman or a British citizen, are backing the literal long-term, incremental, gradual, but still literal genocide of a race of people. And I don't feel that I need to defend myself on a racist charge against someone like you. So I will simply say, yep, I'm a racist, but I'll tell you what, you're a far worse racist than me.
Oh, absolutely. And that is something else, too. What is the problem with wanting to protect our integrity in our culture? The host countries, it seems, and I think that Prime Minister Stephen Harper is seeing a real issue. Well, he does. He sees a real issue with multiculturalism, and I think that is something that he would like to undo, because with multiculturalism in particular, we dilute our own heritage. And I don't understand why it is so wrong to stand up and say, look, this is my heritage, this is my culture, you adapt, do not expect us to adapt to you. Because, for example, in Ontario, Canada, a few years back under the premiership of Dalton McGuinty of the Liberal Party, he was entertaining the idea of introducing Sharia courts. Well, fortunately, that was an outcry of no Sharia courts, because what happened in England is that a couple of imams came to the magistrate and said, hey, give us a couple of Sharia courts, we'll take some cases off your docket, we'll deal with the small things like divorce and family settlements and things like that. But now you're close to 100 Sharia compliant courts in the UK. Canada so far, the United States has Sharia courts. Canada has zero Sharia courts.
Well, that is very, very heartening to hear, and long may that last. It's an interesting thing about multiculturalism, because they divide. If you don't believe in it, you're a member of the far right, and if you do believe in it, you're a member of the compassionate, caring, cuddly left. But let's look at the reasons for it, because it shouldn't be a political issue. It shouldn't be a right-left issue. It should simply be, whether you, for whatever reason, you happen to like multiculturalism. But if you look at it from a left-wing point of view, and you look at, and it's a very hard-line leftist ideology, multiculturalism. But of course, if you go back to the days of communism, there were no multiculturalists in the Politburo. There were no multiculturalists in the Communist Party. There were no multiculturalists in anywhere in the Soviet Socialist Republics. So why exactly are they now so terribly keen to bring all of these foreign races and cultures into the West? And we all know why. It's got absolutely nothing to do with being compassionate, caring, and cuddly. It's got everything to do with the communist long-term plan of subverting Western capitalist Christian countries. And that's exactly why they're doing it, and that's why they've made it a political issue. And they need to be called out on this. Their defense system is to simply say, you are a racist, and it works so well it shuts people up. But what we should be saying is, we're racist. Now, let's look at what you're doing. You are deliberately trying to subvert a race and a culture in order to bring about total economic and social breakdown, in order that you can finally realize your long, long dreams of the communist international. Now, these people are wicked, evil, racist, genocidal racist, And everything they're trying to do has proven in the past to be a total and utter failure wherever communism has sort of laid its hat. It's been environmental catastrophe, social catastrophe, economic catastrophe, gulags, genocide, 150 million people dead. This is the most wicked thing in the world. And we have decided, well, we haven't, but our ruling elites have decided, or they're too frightened to resist it, that this is the future for us. And it's not. You know, we're going to fight back, and we are going to have to beat these bastards at their own game, whatever it takes.
Yeah. I don't know how long we have you for. We taped this show for 2 hours. We're very much enjoying it. The chat room is very, very busy. And I also want to express that Jeff Mitchell of the East Anglian EDO radio show is here right now, and his radio program is probably the only one that actually represents the interests of the English Defence League. I'm wondering, how do you feel about the English Defence League? Is that one of the directions in which England should be going?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't like to see England going in the direction of the English Defence League, because it is riven with all sorts of problems. But I do see an absolute need to have a street movement, because at the moment we have, you know, a few puny, weedy, tiny little organizations like me sort of banging the drum about it, that the media can just ignore us. Now, what the EDL did is they took it to the enemy. They took it out onto the streets. They provided a terrible thorn in the side of the establishment and cost the government large amounts of money in policing these things. And they have been the main difference. You know, the Muslim gang rapes that were going on for 15, 20 years in this country that the police were too frightened to admit to, because they would then be accused of being racist, and the social services were too frightened to admit to, and the politicians were too frightened to admit to, and the media journalists were too frightened to admit to. They all knew it was going on. It was only because the EDL were out on the street drawing attention to it that finally, luckily, fortunately for us, or certainly for young, vulnerable, native British girls, it all came to light. And I don't think that would ever have come out without the input of the English Defence League. So my eternal gratitude goes out to them for that. I don't want to see them disappear now that Tommy and Kev have left. I would love to see them get bigger and stronger and get out there with 5,000, 10,000 in a year's time, 50,000, and not just people in EDL outfits and football supporting types. Get everybody out there. Get a nice mixture of your early EDL boys, and then some working class support, some middle class support. Just get out there. You know, is what I would say to people. I would love to see 100,000 on the streets every weekend. Love it.
If we could get more people, I agree to would support the EDL in that way. That would be good. What I suppose I'd really like to see is Liberty GB capturing some more of more voters from some of the other parties that are currently holding the cards when it comes to our political landscape. You've set out very clearly in the website and your mission statement and so on what your goals are. What do you think is the single biggest thing that you could do as a political party in order to attract people who might be, say, floating voters at the moment?
Well, I think it all comes down to getting mainstream media attention. And if you're the EDL, you can't be ignored, because you're out there and the city is closed off and there are police helicopters. The media simply don't ignore those sort of things. The media can ignore us because we're just writing things and saying things on YouTube videos. Very easy to ignore us. We have to somehow get into the mainstream media. We know the mainstream media do not want us to be publicised by them. They will do everything they can to make sure that we remain quietly tucked away on the edge of the internet somewhere. So this is what it revolves around. Without mainstream coverage, we will remain fairly insignificant. So we simply have to do things to get ourselves into the mainstream media. And whether those are those little stunts that we have come up with and spoken about before, Tim, which I don't want to go into right now because because they're upcoming things in sort of April. This is it. We have to get into the mainstream media.
Okay. Kel, I'll pass that mic back to you for a moment because I know you wanted to ask another question there.
I know we have to let you go. You promised us an hour, and we have been keeping you on for 70 minutes. I'm eternally grateful for all your time. But one thing, I suppose my final question to you would be, when you do enter your, throw your hat in the forum in terms of the elections, what would happen, do you suppose, if you could... Let's just elaborate on my fantasy in that you get a majority election, you get the majority vote. What's the first thing you would do in England to start turning these things around that's strifing England at this point today?
As a, if I was elected as a, as an MP or as an MEP in Europe?
An MP. Hopefully one day you'll be Prime Minister.
Oh, well, if I was Prime Minister, what would I do? I think the very first thing that you have to do is sort out, well, you know, the absolute first thing is to sort out the Islamic side of it and start putting into practice these things of closing down mosques, which are subversive, and kicking out foreign-born imams and refusing to have any more money come in from countries which behave as they do as Saudi Arabia. You know, all those sort of things we could do. But it's not just Islam, you know, because even if we removed Islam from this country, this country still has terrible, terrible problems. And one of the things that I would really like to see done here is to actually educate our children today as they were educated 50 years ago, where they actually learn to read and write and spell and do constructive grammar. And it astonishes me to get emails from people who have been through university in England who write me emails which are semi-literate. This is just the most awful, awful situation. And then everyone wonders why you know, we have to rely on East European people coming here to do the jobs that our kids can't do because they haven't been educated to the most basic levels, which is reading, writing, and adding up. So that needs to be overhauled. And, of course, again, the reason that our education is in such a terrible state is that it is now used as a conduit for left-wing socialist propaganda rather than proper education. So I would be very inhospitable to Islam. I would also be very inhospitable to the teaching unions and to the teacher training colleges, and I would... I would say to someone like Christine Blower, who is the chairman of the National Union of Teachers, which is the biggest teaching profession in this union in this country. She is also a member of the Socialist Alliance or Socialist Action. No, she's another communist. I would say to people like that, what you have done to children in this country is tantamount to child abuse. You were put in charge of their future, and you effectively destroyed their future for them by making them literally unemployable. I consider that to be child abuse. You will stand trial for that, and you will go to jail if you're found guilty. And that's the only way you're going to sort out education in this country. You know, we've got the Education Secretary, Michael Gove, now, who is trying to, you know, to make it a better school system. But he's up against the entire educational establishment is made up of far left socialists. And he, you know, no matter what he does, he's not going to win. What you've got to do is you know, under a proper authoritarian regime, you take out the top 100 of them, you'd shoot them. And then you would immediately find that you had a very responsive teaching profession after that. But obviously, we're not going to take them out and shoot them. But I think you do lock up the top 100 of them and say that's why you're being locked up, because you literally have destroyed children's futures.
Oh, you're not going to you take them out and shoot them. Oh, just a minute while I cross this off my list of suggestions to put into the Liberty GB suggestion box then. Yeah, that's... I do remember somebody saying something very similar not so very long ago. And there's nothing that concentrates a man's mind quite so much as the prospect of being executed in the morning, as I think one statesman famously said maybe a generation or two ago now. So it may sound authoritarian, but sometimes drastic times call for drastic measures. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that we actually do take this particular example and put it into the Liberty GB mission statement. I'm just sort of mentioning it as food for thought. But Michael Gove was famously saying today that he's looking forward to the day when he can make every British public school identical to private schools, so that if you walk round a public school and then walk round a private school, you'll be hard put to tell the difference. And I remember listening to that particular sentence and saying, well, I'm not going to hold my breath for that one, because, as you say, he is up against it with the educational establishment there. But in addition to sorting out the Islamic problem and then the educational establishment, are there any other glaring things that stand out that you would like to tackle as a matter of urgency, Paul?
I would like to obviously sort out the media and get the media to report things in a true, factual, unbiased way. Which again would take a revolution, quite frankly, because they would have now to be frightened into it. Now, the trouble that we're facing here is that when the left, who, let's face it, killed 100 million people in the last century, when the intolerant, violent left infiltrated all the institutions of this country, they were able to do it because the people they were replacing simply had no idea what sort of people these leftists were. You know, these tweedy old buffers in suits with leather patches on their elbows in the teaching profession, they had no idea what was happening. But now these leftists are in control. They know exactly what they're doing. They know how political everything has now become. They will not be pushed out easily. So it will literally take a revolution to remove them. And we do have to have that revolution, and we do have to remove them. And this brings me on to the whole thing about political correctness. Now, we live, no matter which government is in power in this country, or even in most Western European countries and America, North America today, it doesn't matter who's in power. Political correctness rules okay. Everywhere is now subjected to this self-censorship of people and to this regime, which was built for one reason only, which was essentially to declare war on white, Christian, heterosexual, capitalist countries. And, of course, men, the dreadful patriarchy. And until we can overthrow the entire doctrine of political correctness, we are only going to become worse and worse and worse. And I'm talking worse in educational terms, moral terms, spiritual terms, economic terms. And something, for example, like gay marriage. Now, why is gay marriage such a huge thing at the moment? And it's not just, people don't seem to realize how widespread the leftist control of the entire Western world is now. We're all over here talking about gay marriage, and it suddenly occurs to us that, hold on, they're talking about it in America as well, and they're talking about it in Holland, and they're talking about it in France. Why is it happening in all of these countries all at the same time? It must be coming from the top down somewhere. And, of course, it is. And the whole thing with gay marriage, left-wing people do not like the institution of marriage because marriage stands as a bulwark against the power of the state, you know, a wife listens to her husband, the husband listens to her wife, the children listen to the parents. That's not what the left want. The left want total and utter control. So what they need to do is break down the institution of marriage, which they've done very successfully. And, of course, as a result of that, children suffer. So when people, when lefties now say to me, oh, you're homophobic because you don't agree with the with gay marriage, my reply to them is the only people that I am interested in when it comes to marriage is the best interests of the child. And that is the reason for getting married. You can have a civil partnership. The reason for getting married is to reflect your commitment to children and to their best interests. And everybody knows that married couples are far less likely to abuse their children. But the left don't give a stuff about that. They don't give a stuff about the children. What they care about is just reducing the institution of marriage, the institute of marriage. And here's another thing. All the years that they were saying marriage is a terrible bourgeois, capitalist, female, oppressive, Christian regime. Now homosexuals want to do it. It's suddenly the thing that we've all got to be supporting, because suddenly marriage is permissible only as long as homosexuals want to do it. This is a deliberately destructive ploy to break down traditional marriage, and this is just one example of the damage and destruction and wickedness of left-wing ideology and political correct ideology. And I would wage an absolute war with the entire section of the community who support and promote political correctness.
I've got a couple more callers on the line, Paul. Would you take a question? I've got two callers on the line. Kel, who have we got?
We've got Jeff Mitchell of the East Anglian EDL radio show and Mike Holt of Restore Australia. Jeff was here first, so Paul, we appreciate that you're
hey, Kel,
staying
Kel, that's,
over.
That's fine. That's fine. I'll stay on till the end.
Oh,
wonderful,
brilliant.
Paul.
Thanks very much,
Thank
Paul.
You
That's
so
great.
Very much with your generous time. We really appreciate that. And with that, I'm going to bring on Jeff Mitchell of EDL Radio. And Jeff, welcome to the program. Hi, boss.
Hi, Kel. Hi, Tim. And it's great to hear you once again, Paul, what you've been saying tonight. And one of the things I called in was when we were talking about the children, the indoctrination of the children in our schools. And I did say in the chat, this has got to stop now, because the damage is being done. What can we do? We must stop it now. And we can see exactly what's being taught in these schools. We hear from the children, talking about what have you done? Oh, we were talking about Muhammad today and things like that. This is the things that's coming out of schools. This is what it used to be like, Paul. And this is what I'm saying. This is the social engineering that's been going on for such a long time, I would say, has been very much stealth-like in its way. But we can see now, ourselves looking in, we can see exactly how it's unfolded. And your thoughts on that, what I just spoke about, Paul.
Well, you're absolutely right, especially you say that it's been a long process. It has, because you cannot have you can have an overnight revolution. It happened in Russia in 1919. But if you cannot do the overnight revolution with guns, what you have to do is a 10, 20, 30, 40, 50-year-old revolution, but by stealth and by gradual progress. And that's what these bastards have done. And now they control the minds of our children. And you have this amazing thing in schools now where non-Muslim teachers have to hand out the Quran wearing rubber gloves because they're not allowed to touch the holy book with their dirty, filthy, infidel fingers. And they seem to think this is completely normal. And the children now think it's completely normal. I was talking to a 13-year-old the other day that said he was ashamed to be white. He could think of nothing to be proud of as far as his British background was. And it's much cooler much cooler and more down with it man to be black. And he also doesn't want to have any children because he has been told that in 50 years' time the world will be on fire because of global warming. And I was thinking, you know, when I was at school, none of this happened. When I was at school, you know, we were taught where capital cities of the world was, something about truck farming in California, kings and queens of England and proper history, and how to read and write and add up. And now they're told all this stuff, which is just basically left-wing propaganda rather than teaching them. And it's hideous. And unfortunately, if you have lots of money and you go to a private school, you can escape all of this. But if you can't afford it, and some of these fees now are 15, 20 grand a year, you know, I'm astonished anyone can afford it. But if you're an average person in this country and you have children, you have to stick them into this state school knowing that they are going to take your child away from you ideologically. It's terrifying.
It certainly is, Paul, and I'm very much in the thoughts with you that we've, thank goodness, and I always speak about on the show that we need more people like yourself, Paul, the people that will stand up and speak about the things that's so important. And we're talking about indoctrination in our schools, which is one of the most important things I can think about, apart from the so-called the grooming, let's call it Islamic slavery of these young children as well. This is the things that we've got to contend with. Thank goodness, Paul, that we've got great politicians like yourself, that we have got that caliber of people, and I've been calling for this for such a long time. You know, David Cameron's and the Nick Clegg's. This is not what this country needs. We need strong leadership, and with people like yourself, someone like yourself, Paul, could really steady this ship. We do need people of your caliber, and that's why I was calling as well. I've been following you very closely lately. You're doing great work, Liberty GB. Put this way, Paul, I'll be voting for you, and I hope that a lot of the EDL members will vote for you as well, because this is what this country needs, people like your caliber. Back to you, Paul.
Well, Jeff, I'm very, very grateful to you for saying that, and thank you so much, and I will return the compliment and say that what I might be able to do in 5 years' time, that might happen, but what you're doing now today with the EDL is making an effect right now today. So, you know, I think what you're doing is absolutely necessary and brave and committed and absolutely fantastic, Jeff. So hats off to you, fella.
And, Jeff, thank you so very much for calling into the program. Oh, boy, I sure appreciate it. And full disclosure here, I'm the producer of the East Anglian EDL radio program, heard here Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 8:30 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. So when my boss calls in, I know that I'm not fired. We have another caller here, Paul, and he has been waiting a while. And this is Mike Holt of Restore Australia. Boy, another disclosure. I produce his radio program.
are you seeing a pattern here, Paul?
I think I am, Tim, yeah.
But I want to bring Mike on right now. And hi, Mike. Welcome to the program. What's your question and comment for Paul Weston?
Oh, good morning, and first of all...
Good morning, Mike.
Very pleased to meet you. I have been following your activities over there and love what you're doing. Was it you that confronted or went over to, what's his name's house, the Muslim idiot?
No, that wasn't. That was the Britain First outfit.
My apologies. I'm sitting here feeling very uncomfortable at the moment because I'm sitting on my copy of the Quran. I thought it might be. I've just been reading it, and to be honest with you, I'm so upset with the way things are going, I'm about to tear out a page. There you go. That's what we should be doing, that thing. No.
Soft, strong, and very absorbent.
Not very absorbent, I'm afraid. I've still got a sore backside. But I don't care. If they don't like it, then they shouldn't act the way that they do. I've just published an article on our website under recent posts on the right-hand side entitled Dire Consequences. And we are facing a grave danger here at the moment in Australia. We have three mosques being applied for, one in the city of Ballarat, another one in the city of Bendigo, Twin Cities, and another one in Bunbury over in Western Australia. It seems all the bees are copying it this week. But we've got people on the ground, not enough at this stage, but we do have people on the ground and more volunteers turning up each day fighting against these. And I just wanted to let you know that here in Australia, we can see the danger that has happened in the UK, and we are taking the lesson to heart. So I want to thank you for your work. You're doing a fantastic job. And I think by sharing information, we can all work together and we can stop Islamization of the West.
Great. I quite agree with you there, Mike. What's your... I was going to look this thing up on the Dire Consequences, but what's the name of your website?
RestoreAustralia.org.au.
RestoreAustralia.org.au. Lovely. I will have a look at that.
Great. All right, mate. Thank you very much. I've got to go because I've got to get the kids off to school. And I hope that they don't get indoctrinated while they're there today.
All right, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you so very much for calling in, and I will see you on Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on Blog Talk Radio. That is Mike Holt of Restore Australia, and I put the link in the chat room for everybody to peruse. Mike Holt is the proprietor behind everything over there, doing great works. That is Mike Holt.
Sorry, Ken, does he do anything with the Australian Q Society?
I am not too sure about that. That's really interesting. You know what? That's something that he should discuss on his radio program this Wednesday. That would be very interesting.
Because it was the Q Society that got Geert Wilders out to Australia at some point, I think it was last year. And then when they got him there, they found that the rooms which had been booked, the conference rooms which had been booked at the Hyatt, I think was one of them, the Hyatt hotel chain. Of course, it turns out that the Hyatt is actually owned by a Saudi wealth fund or a Qatari wealth fund.
Oh, really?
So when they discovered that it was Geert Wilders, suddenly the venues were pulled. I think all the venues were pulled, and it was only because of local people. One of them was an Iraqi Christian who had made some money there and had access to some hall, and he set it up for him. You know, an Iraqi organized it for Geert Wilders, but you know, only because he was a Christian. But yeah, you know, Australia again has huge problems, as we well know. I think it's an awful lot of Lebanese ones, and it was, I don't remember the name of the beach where all the riots were a few years ago, but
was
I do
Bondi?
Know that the
Bondi Beach possibly.
I don't think it was Bondi. I've forgotten what it might have been, Tim. But I do remember the chief mufti of Australia. Don't remember his name, but he was saying, "Look," he said, "if you put meat, uncovered meat outside, you know, you can't blame cats for coming to eat it. So, you know, if you put uncovered women on beaches, you can't blame Muslim males for raping them." I thought, really? That's what you think of it? That's how bad it is in Australia now? I would never have thought that would be allowed to take place in Australia.
Yeah, I remember this. I remember this guy saying that, and he was rightly taken to task for it at the time. And I think even nowadays they still refer to him as the uncovered meat sheikh whenever his name comes up. I haven't got his name in front of me. Sheikh Taj bin something or other, not Taj bin Al Halal, because that sounds far too. Far too easy to recall it. It's something like that, though. One of the things I was going to ask you about was something that came up in the chat room just now, not specifically to do with Australia, but it was to do with voting fraud. And I was somebody was saying that voting fraud seems to be endemic whenever you get Muslims, and my perception is it's tied into the fact that a lot of places now don't have the requirement to vote in person. I don't think this is true of Australia. I think with Australia. You actually have to, by law, and I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, I think you have to actually turn up in person if you're going to vote in federal elections, and if you don't turn up, then I think that that's, they make that a criminal offence unless you've got a very good reason. Do you think that such a thing ought to be instituted here in the UK?
I think it is absolutely essential. I can't remember all the instances off the top of my head now, but anyone that is interested, if they Google Banana Republic Britain and my name, I wrote an article about Muslim voting fraud a couple of years ago. And Baroness Varsi, who is now the, whatever she is, the pet Muslim in David Cameron's outfit, said in 2010 that the Conservatives had lost the majority election because of Muslim voting fraud, and there was a little tiny intake of breath, and then suddenly that whole story disappeared from the front page and was never spoken of again. So I did some research into the whole electoral fraud, Muslim fraud thing, and it turns out that there's an area in Pakistan called Mirpur, and British politicians go to Mirpur to canvass for votes at election time. You know, this. I know this sounds unbelievable, but this is true, because we have so many proxy votes for dual nationality Pakistanis who take their proxy vote form back to Mirpur, where we have to go and pander to their vote. And you also had the mayor of Mirpur, who obviously is a Pakistani Muslim, who visits Pakistani Muslim places in this country and tells the Muslims who to vote for. And the Independent newspaper, which of course is a left-wing organization, even they had to do some reporting on this, and they sent one of their reporters down to Tower Hamlets, I think it was, because what was happening in Tower Hamlets, the local postman is a Muslim. So the local postman is quite happy to have in his postal sack electoral vote forms for houses in one particular street numbering 50 to 100. But in actual fact, that street only had 50 houses in it. The 50 to 100 are phantom houses with 20, 30 people living in each one. So he simply takes all of these forms which he has, and he distributes them to the local mosque, and the local mosque then gets various people to sign them. I mean, it is absolutely outrageous levels of Muslim electoral fraud goes on in this country. And the nice thing was that when they sent the Independent journalist down there was a photograph of him. He was about 25 years old with a sort of left-wing beard and glasses and that general sort of rather sad left-wing sort of face about him. You know, the sort of bloke who was completely... Yeah, the sort of
I have to laugh because you draw such a wonderful picture when you say that. Sorry, I'm interrupting you, Paul.
Well, you know, it's just the sort of bloke that, you know, when he was at school, he was no good at sport. You know, he never got invited round the back of the bike sheds by any of the girls. He grew up all embittered and unhappy and became, of course, a left-wing journalist.
A lefty.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they're all the same. You know, you don't find very many handsome, athletic people joining the ranks of the left wing, do you? Ever.
No.
It's almost
impossible. You mentioned it. I can't think of one.
No, you see. So they sent him. His name was Jerome as well. And I remember writing the intrepidly bearded Jerome, whatever his name was, went down to investigate this, knocked on a door of a flat, and asked the Muslim guy that came to the door why such a small flat seemed to have 20 people living in it. So the Muslim just punched him on the nose, broke his nose, and told him to fuck off. So, you know, one wonders how many times that has to happen to an intrepidly bearded left-wing journalist before he finally sees the light. But probably quite a few times would be the answer.
Yes. Yeah, the more the better, in my view. In fact, I think it should be compulsory for left-wing journalists to actually have that experience. You know, we could set up schools where they have to go and knock on doors and the door opens and a big fist comes out and smacks them right in the nose, and they have to have that at least a minimum of 3 times before they can pass the course and go on to the next stage of their training. In fact, I think we should include that in your mission statement, Paul. I really do. It would be a wonderful addition. But yeah, I mean, voting fraud is a huge issue. And I remember stories going back quite a while here in Birmingham when you were talking about Banana Republic voting fraud. And I think a judge in Birmingham at the trial of some of the people who were involved, they said that the practices would shame a Banana Republic. And I think that's another thing that needs to be addressed as soon as possible. When we get some sanity restored back to the political landscape, we want to make sure that all the steps that we want to take are not subverted by fraudulent voting practices, because otherwise we'll be right back where we started.
Absolutely. I think it's I was saying earlier on about the fact that I don't really see Islamic terrorism as a long-term threat to this country. You know, it can be contained, it can be dealt with. We are going to have several hundred more people killed by them, but we're not going to lose the country because of Islamic terrorism. We are going to lose the country because only, 50 or 60% of us bother voting anyway, whereas 100% of the Muslims will vote completely. You know, they will be almost forced to vote by the local imam. And while we are also not all of us voting anyway, we're also splitting our vote between UKIP and Lib Dems and Conservatives and Labour, and of course that huge chunk that will be voting for Liberty GB. So there is this spread of votes amongst a group of people who not all are voting, whereas the Muslims will all vote, and they will all vote for only one organization in the future, which will be the Islamic Party, you know, in 10, 15 years' time. So it doesn't need anywhere near a 50-50 split in the demographics of this country for them to win the general election. They can do it well before that, simply because they all vote and they all only vote one way. So, and of course, they cheat as well I'm not going to say what I was going to say because I'm a future politician, but they cheat because they come from thoroughly, utterly corrupt countries, and they brought their thoroughly, utterly corrupt practices with them, which, of course, we should celebrate because that's part of our multicultural nirvana that we now live in. But yes, you know, you get my drift.
Oh, well, yes, indeed. And the corruption factor is, of course, a reason why we should be extremely careful about not just the aspects of voting, but, again, when we get sanity restored to the political landscape, we should look very carefully about any positions of authority which might be influenced by corrupt practices, whether that's national or local government or the military or the judiciary or the criminal justice system. As you say, I don't want to draw you too much on this, because obviously there are factors which could be construed as quite sensitive, but I think we all agree that these are going to have to be addressed in the not too distant future if our society is going to retain any integrity at all. But with that, what I'd like to do, Paul, is pass the microphone back to Kel, because I think she's got one or two other questions that she would like to ask you. So, Kel?
Okay, Tim and Kel, just before Kel takes over, just let me say one thing quickly about the veering away slightly from the electoral fraud, but this whole thing with the fact that when they get to a certain level, here's something that is a terrible, terrible problem in this country. We have 60,000 women and girls who've undergone female genital mutilation, which is against the law. There has not been a single arrest. Now, ask yourselves why there has not been a single arrest, and the answer is because every single one of those girls goes to a Muslim doctor. They don't go to an English doctor. an English doctor would report the parents. They go to a Muslim doctor, so it's all kept within the Muslim community, and we, the state, Britain, the police, the judicial system, is kept away from this. And that really is my point about the fact that when there's a sufficient number of them to block those and block this and block that, they can also block female genital mutilation as well and keep it within their incestuous little Muslim world. Sorry, Kel, over to you.
Just to add on to that too, Paul, is that it would be that vacation time is here, kids, pack your bags. We're going to Pakistan, and we knew what was going on, especially when you're dealing with 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old little girls. And the British authorities, they were cottoning on to this, and they were telling the girls, put a spoon or something in your underclothes, and that will set the alarms off at the airport. But what I'm discovering is that they are actually importing these cutters into the UK.
Mm.
They're all pulling their money together and importing these cutters.
Nope, that's it. And also these ones tend not to be Pakistani. These are a lot of them are North African and Somali and whatever.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was just speaking generically. Yeah,
and they do it. You know, they do it without anaesthetic, and they use mm-hmm. traditional Somali instruments to actually make the cut, such as the lid of a tin. I mean, it's just terrific, and they don't bother sterilizing it because they don't understand that if you boil them, you know, it's pretty good for not getting any future infections. They just do it anyway. It's just such a savage, third world, backward, obscene political religious ideology. It really is.
We are down to our last 15 minutes. And Paul, you have been so generous with your time. I would like you to expand on Liberty GB, the website. I've been putting the links in there. But you have a real crack team joining you. But there is one in particular that I really like, and that is Enza Ferrari. And she works with issues of animals. And the reason why she is so close to my heart is because she does speak out about animal cruelty. I have been espousing the issue of halal slaughter, and that's what Mike Holt does. He is the man behind the sticker campaign, Stop Halal Meat in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Halal slaughter, I am so glad that Enza is on your team.
Well, you know, Enza's fantastic. She's far better educated than all the rest of us. Well, except for one. Actually, that actually isn't true. We've now got two PhD people on the executive council, which is pretty good. I'm thick as a brick. I was expelled from school, so I don't really count in those terms. But Enza's got some sort of degree in philosophy or something, and she talks about Nietzsche and Socrates. So yes, it's all rather wonderful mm-hmm. in terms of those sort of things. And she is. She's absolutely passionate about animals. You know, about all animals, not just halal, but about animals generally. So we are getting all of our sort of bases covered there. And I'm glad that that resonates with you as well, because this is something else that when people talk about British culture, and you know they say, well, British culture, what is it exactly? It's dancing around a maypole. It's oppressing dark people in foreign countries and stealing their wealth. Da 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 da. You know, one of the things about British culture is the way that we treat animals, and this is the way we treat animals is not the same as everywhere else in the world. No, in the civilized world, I suppose it is, but I don't really agree with riding donkeys until they have heart attacks with fat men on them in Spain, you know, for a bit of a giggle. So I think that we're more uh-huh. advanced than the Spaniards are. You know, the English, the British, and all the people who went out from England and Britain, a few hundred years ago, took that love of animals with them. And that is part of British culture. And that is the part of the culture that the horrible little lefties will deny even exists. But it's a fact. We are nice people. And you can always tell nice people, it's how they treat their animals.
Absolutely. And on that note, I am going to thank you very, very much for joining Tim and myself on the Red Fox Blogger. And we hope that you will come back. I have had the this is the fastest 2 hours I've ever had on this show, Paul.
Yeah,
but please tell, I'm going to pass the mic to Tim because Tim is the radio host on Liberty GB Radio, and I'm going to let you and Tim discuss where people can find you right here on Block Talk Radio.
Okay, so well, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'm glad it's gone quickly for you. It's it was just as good for me, baby. So and I look forward to speaking to you the next time.
Absolutely, Paul. Absolutely, anytime.
Well, thank you, Kel. And yes, as you say, Liberty GB Radio. We haven't actually been going that long in terms of Blog Talk Radio as part of the social media package that Liberty GB employ. Only a couple of months, and we've only actually had a couple of radio shows. But we have got some radio shows that are going to be coming up this week and next week, which I'd like to advise everybody about now. I haven't got the links made up as we speak, but I will be posting them on Red Fox Blogger, on Kel's Red Fox Blogger website, and on my own Twitter timeline. That's Follow the Cat at CatStrangler101, and I'll be bringing it to everybody's attention in between now and the time the shows happen, whenever I get the opportunity. The first episode I would like to tell you about is occurring later this week on Thursday the 6th of February at 7 o'clock 1900 GMT. That's I'll have to do the calculations. I think that's 1400 Eastern Time. And we're going to be interviewing Bill Warner, Dr. Bill Warner, on Liberty GB Radio at that time. Very pleasant man, very knowledgeable about Islam. He writes and speaks about Islam in a very fluent, articulate way, and a way that imparts a marvelous degree of clarity to the issues that are involved. So if you have an opportunity to tune in, on Thursday the 6th of February at 1900 GMT, please do, because Bill Warner, I'm sure, will be a very informative and entertaining guest on our show. And on the following week, on Thursday the 13th of February, again at 1900 GMT, we will have with us Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch. And that also, I'm sure, will be a very informative and entertaining show. Robert Spencer, as I'm sure most of you are aware, is so knowledgeable about Islam that when he was interviewed recently and he was debating an imam on various subjects, the imam actually deferred to him and said, "I can't answer that question because you are far more knowledgeable about it than I am." And the interviewer who was moderating between Robert Spencer and this particular imam was quite surprised, to say the least. He said, "But you're an imam." And the imam said, "Oh, but Robert Spencer knows so much more about it than I do." So he's a very, very knowledgeable, entertaining person, and we're very honoured to have Robert Spencer with us on Thursday the 13th of February at 1900 GMT. So please join us on one or both of those dates. And
wonderful.
I'll pass it
wonderful.
On to you, Kel.
What a fantastic lineup everybody is having. And also to remind people, Dr. Bill Warner will also be joining Tim and myself tomorrow evening right here, the Freedom-Loving Infidels, heard right here on Radio Jihad Network on Blog Talk Radio tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. These people are out there. They're busy. They're out there, and they're for you. Paul, I want to thank you so very much for joining us today, and thank you so much for your generous time once again.
That, as I say, Kel, it's been a pleasure and a privilege being on there. I'll say one thing about Bill Warner. If people haven't heard him speak, there is a very famous YouTube clip, which I think is something, if you Google 1400 years, Islam, 1400 years of history, Bill Warner, you'll find it. I think it's got up to about a million hits now. And it's long.
Gosh.
I think it's 48 minutes long. But he outlines exactly what they're up to. So anyone that wants to have a look at that before they listen to him tomorrow, you know, they will then know that this guy has just got Islam in his sights. He knows about it and he's prepared to talk about it. Fantastic guy, Bill Warner.
Absolutely, and I'm looking forward to hearing him on your program as well.
Now, Kel and Tim, I am going to leg it now. I'm absolutely gagging for a fag, so that's what I'm going to do.
I'm going to send you an e-cigarette in the mail, Paul.
And just for our listeners across the pond in the United States, gagging for a fag means something quite different where you are compared to where we are in the United Kingdom. But don't let it worry you. Paul's just going out for a cigarette.
No, I'm not. I don't smoke.
Oh dear. Oh, sorry about that, Paul. I completely misunderstood.
Well, now I know there's a difference. You know, I went to the doctor the other day because I'm getting on a bit. I'm 50 years old now, and he said, do you do any exercise? And I said, well, I don't really do a great deal. And he said, well, listen, you need to do something several times a week that at least makes you feel, you know, just even a little bit breathless. And I said, well, smoking makes me feel breathless, so I'd better start that again.
Paul, you have to come back because we're going to rebook this show as Comedy Central.
Well, you should. I tell you what, we should do one day. We should try. I'm stone cold sober right now, and I'm more fluid and relaxed, you know, after a couple of beers. We should do it after a couple of beers one day. We should all have a couple of beers and do it.
It's a date. Oh, let's do that. We'll play the drinking game. Every time that we can nail down an Islamist, we take a shot of whiskey or something. What do you think?
I think that is absolutely brilliant. I'm completely up for it.
We're on to it. Oh, Paul, I will be in touch with you definitely because I am going to get the links for the upcoming shows, and I will put them on the ReFox blogger for everybody, and I'll make sure that they're plastered everywhere, so everybody be there.
Brilliant.
Paul?
Thanks for having me, Kel. Thanks for having me on there as well, Tim, and I'll speak to you tomorrow, Tim, and I'll speak to you next time, Kel, and I look forward to it.
Absolutely, yes, Paul. Thank you so very, very much.
Yeah, thank you for being here, Paul. Been great.
Cheers, Tim. Cheers, Tim. Cheers, Kel. Bye.
Okay,
have
bye.
A great evening. And ladies and gentlemen, that was wonderful. That was Paul Weston of the Liberty GB joining us this evening. And if you couldn't be here live, you can certainly hear it in archive. It will go to archive within 20 minutes. I also want to remind you, like I say, that we are the freedom-loving infidels at Radio Jihad Network. And our boss, Vito Esposito, he has his program tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So try to be there for that. Tim, it was a blast once again.
It was. Tremendous. I'm still laughing about getting the fag. I thought they're never going to get that. They're never going to get that over the United States, so I better just explain it.
It was funny. Oh, gosh. You know what? I'm not going to play out with the normal Red Fox blogger song. I got a really good one here that we're going to play out with, Tim.
Okay.
Hey, look, I will be speaking with you, oh, my gosh, tomorrow.
Yes, indeed.
At the Freedom Loving Infidel.
Yes, indeed.
Tim?
I look forward to that.
Everybody, thank you very much for joining us. We had quite a few people in our chat room. It was very, very busy. Bigfoot, Catform, Drake's Drums, Eric Kyle, numerous guests, Luchadora, Moving Forward, No Way 90, Paul Alexander, Vito Esposito, various people on the studio joining us, our Sweet Sue from New Mexico. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. We will be back here again Monday. You will see me flying solo on Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but Tim and myself together
We'll see you tomorrow at the Freedom Loving Infidels heard on Radio Jihad Network. Tim, have a great night.
Yes, indeed. Well, good night, everybody, and thank you for joining us tonight. And join us again soon, Freedom Loving Infidels. Tomorrow night, as Kel said, at 11 o'clock GMT, 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Look forward to seeing you then.
Keep hope alive.
I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb.
Keep hope alive.
Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had. Give you the will to carry on another day. Another day goes by and you're outside, still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive. Until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy, want your foolish pride, want your beautiful joy. Even what's left of a candy bar when looks like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood that created a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats gave you the strength of a thousand men. Gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them. And you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna fall. Some harm's way, putting in all those hours, and all my friends working day and night, making it right here, tunnel of towers, bringing us hope like a ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds, clearing the showers. Well, here's to you, two shots of whiskey, one Jameson, one Johnny Powers. From Coney Island to Seaside Heights, Long Beach, Freeport, the Lower East Side, mass of people, the sheep's head.